Welcome back to the program as we spend some time talking about a deeply personal story of one of the 20th century's great historical secrets, the long and difficult trek of Southern blacks to the northern and western cities of America. It is one of the most significant, yet little-noted shifts in the history of the country, the migration of African Americans from the Jim Crow South to the more welcoming cities of the North and West. It was a complicated process, one that raised issues of power, politics, religion, and class. We're going to talk about that remarkable journey in the context of a remarkable new book by my guest, Isabel Wilkerson. She won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing for her work as a Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times, making her the first black woman in history of American journalism to win a Pulitzer Prize. She's lectured at the Nieman Foundation at Harvard University. She's won numerous other prizes, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and a George Polk Award. She's currently a professor of journalism and the director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. It is my pleasure to have Isabel Wilkerson here to talk about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. Isabel Wilkerson, thanks so much for joining us.
So great to be here.
Great to have you here. This is a story that took place, you talk about, from basically the end of World War I through 1970. And yet it is one that as I say in the introduction, was sort of little noted and little attention has been paid to what a dramatic story it was. Why is that, do you think?
Well, part of it is because it went on for so long, it would have been difficult for reporters who basically do the first rough draft of history to have covered it for that long a period of time. It went on for nearly 60 years. And at the beginning of it, one of our most famous poets, Carl Sandburg, was actually a reporter who was one of the first to write about it in Chicago. So you can see how long ago that was.
And when we look at that period of time, talk a little bit about how the nature of that migration, how that shift changed over such a long period of time.
That shift began with World War I, where the North finally recognized that it had this great need for labor, and that was because the European war had shut off immigration, so they had this great need for labor, and they began to recruit people in the South very quietly and surreptitiously, actually, because the South was quite unhappy with the idea of losing its cheap labor. And so recruiters would go down, and they'd have to be very cautious. There were many efforts to keep the people from leaving. When the people would be many African Americans waiting on the railroad platforms, police or the sheriffs would come and arrest them wholesale for under peonage laws or under charges that they might have owed the owner of the land whose land they had worked. They would board the trains and pull people off of the trains, actually arrest them for those same reasons. And when those things didn't work, they actually, if they saw large numbers of African Americans trying to leave certain train stations in the South, they would actually wave the train on through so that it wouldn't stop to pick them up. They also exacted exorbitant fees for Northerners who would come in and try to recruit. In one place, they charged $25,000. To anyone who wanted to come down and recruit people in Georgia, which was unbelievable now, and it would be astronomical in 1917.
Talk a little bit about the decisions that were made by African Americans in the South to make this trek, to make this journey. Who within that population wanted to do this, and what were some of the motivations?
You know, that is really getting to the central reason why I wanted to do this book and why I wanted to explore this and why I spent 15 years tracking down people who had been a part of this. Essentially, they wanted to leave for the same reason that anyone would ever want to cross the Atlantic in steerage or come across the Pacific or across the Rio Grande. Essentially, it was a sense of longing and determination to leave. Anyone who makes this journey to leave the only place they'd ever known for a place that they've never seen with no guarantee of success means that there's something very special about that person, and that's a classic American story. I mean, essentially all of us, as it turns out, have something in our backgrounds like this. How many people are the products of someone who, a great grandmother who came from Ireland and a great grandfather who came from Italy, met in this country and then have a whole new lineage. I mean, that is the story of America in many respects. And this was this a migration of people who had that same longing to escape a caste system that held them down, humiliated them in ways that are hard to imagine, and left for the same reasons that anyone else would, the kind of classic immigrant heart. And in some ways, they were defections from the South as much as a migration. They were almost seeking political asylum to find their own way in a new land.
One of the points you make is that in other waves of immigration, exactly as you say, that it was people that were special, that had that fire in the belly, that determination to make that journey, to leave some place that was comfortable, for some place that they had no sense of at all. And along with that determination, in many cases, came a degree of success in whatever that particular immigrant group set out to do. Talk about the way that played itself out with respect to the African-American community.
Well, one thing to remember is, you know, how do you define success? I mean, for them, they were coming from a world and a caste system in which they were held down to such a degree that their every movement, their every aspect of their life, anything that could be imagined to control was controlled. For example, it was illegal. It was against the law for a black person and a white person to play checkers together in Birmingham. That is astounding that someone would even sit down and think of to write down such a law. There were actually in many courtrooms in the South, there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. So they were leaving such a desperate circumstances, such a harsh and mean world in many respects, that how you define success in some ways was just by getting out, because many of them had to leave in the middle of the night. They could not tell people that they were about to leave. Someone might tell someone else, and then they might be kept from leaving. So in some ways it was an escape from the South. So how you define success in that respect partly is just getting out, number one. And then number two, their expectations were modest. They weren't coming to, you know, to run, you know, major corporations and own, you know, gigantic buildings. They really wanted to just be able to get an education for their children. They themselves may have only been able to go to the eighth grade. And if they'd gone even further, they were segregated schools that were by no means equal. They wanted to be able to have own their own home as opposed to working someone else's land. Their goals were modest. And in those respects, getting out in some ways and being able to live free was its own success.
Talk about the way it hollowed out the South in terms of who was left after these people left.
At the beginning of the 20th century, before the migration began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the end of the Great Migration in the 1970s, nearly half of all African Americans were living in the North and West, this great arc from Washington to Boston to Chicago and over to Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, this entire great arc. And that meant it was almost an entire redistribution of an entire population of people within the United States. And thus, that means that the majority of African Americans that you meet in the North, the Midwest, and the West are descendants of this great migration.
And those that were left behind, those that stayed in the South, talk about the impact that had on them.
It had a great impact on them as well. I mean, there are very few people in this country who have not been affected by the Great Migration, because it had so huge an impact on the culture of the United of that we now take for granted: music, literature, sports. I mean, so many aspects of life, because they transferred Southern culture when they brought them, when they basically in their cardboard suitcases to the North, Midwest, and West.
Talk a little bit about the three characters. You really focus this story on three specific characters that you use to tell this greater story. Talk about that.
Yes, three amazing characters in their own right. It took me a year and a half just to even find them. I went all over the place to AARP meetings and Juneteenth celebrations and all kinds of places, senior centers, in order to find them. One of them, each one of them represents the three major streams of the Great Migration. One was up the East Coast from Georgia, Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, up to Washington, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. And the person who represents that is a man named George Starling, who was a college student who had to drop out because there were no options for African Americans at that time to go to school in most of the schools in Florida, except for one which was far away from his home, and the family could no longer send him, which meant he was forced to have to work in the predominant labor industry that was in his hometown, which was picking citrus. It was dangerous work. They had to climb into 30 and 40 foot trees. Many people would fall out of the trees. They had to splice ladders together in order to get into these trees. So it was very dangerous work. And on top of that, they were not being paid well. They were being paid 10 or 12 cents a box, which would then go on the open market for as much as $3 or $4. And he began arguing for or agitating for better wages, meaning a nickel more per box. He began organizing the pickers, and they would do work stoppages in order to get a little bit more, and they succeeded for a while. But then word got back to him that there was something very terrible being planned for him, and he had to flee for his life, and he ended up in Harlem. The second person represents the Midwestern stream from Mississippi and Arkansas, parts of Alabama, to the Great Midwest, which were the cities that they went to were Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Minneapolis. And this is a woman whose name was Ida Mae Gladney, and she was a sharecropper's wife who was terrible at picking cotton, just awful at it. She could kill a snake, but she couldn't pick cotton. And she and her family ended up having to leave also quietly and in secret after a cousin of her husband's had been beaten to within an inch of his life over a theft that he had not committed. The thing that they thought he had stolen turned up the next day, and after discovering what had happened to the cousin, the husband came home to his wife and he said, "This is the last crop we're making," and they headed to the Midwest. And then finally, the third person was Dr. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, who was a physician in the Army. It turned out that after the Korean War, after he'd served his country, it turned out that he could not practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana. And so he set out on a surprisingly treacherous journey across the country, across the desert from Monroe, Louisiana to California. He drove all the way to Oakland, where there was a large contingent of people from his small town of Monroe, Louisiana. Interestingly enough, these migrations were not haphazard unfurlings of lost souls. They were as predictable as certain people, as people from Sweden and Norway ending up in Minnesota. There were specific places that people went. They didn't just happen to end up anywhere. So because he was from Monroe, Louisiana, he set out on a course for California, because that is where people from Monroe, Louisiana ended up going. And two of the most famous people who were part of that great migration were Huey Newton, whose parents also migrated from Monroe, Louisiana to Oakland, and then Bill Russell. Bill Russell, the great defensive player, one of the greatest NBA players of all time, whose parents migrated from Monroe, Louisiana, also in the 1940s. So there's this great legacy of people migrating from Louisiana to the Bay Area.
And the other part of these three characters, beyond the differences in where they came from and where they went, is that they all adjusted to the circumstances they found in very different ways.
They did, and in some ways I think that there's a lesson for all of us beyond just the whole idea of this great migration, this underreported story, one of the great stories, classic American stories of the 20th century. Beyond that is a lesson of longevity, because they all adjusted differently, and they all had different kinds of success. The physician who came out to California ended up finally in Los Angeles, and he was an amazing success as a physician. He became physician to Ray Charles. He had so many people that were coming to him. He had this folksy Southern way about him that was endearing to so many people that people actually waited in the waiting area and in the hallways of his office like refugees. They'd be sitting in the hallway waiting to see him because he was just that great of a doctor. And to tell you the truth, he's such a character that a lot of them knew that, and this is a whole other part of the story, a lot of them knew they, that they were waiting for him to get back from the racetrack, which is a whole other story because he also was this inveterate gambler, but just an amazing character unto himself. So he actually had great success financially, but had always this longing, this kind of exile's obsession with the past, really truly never got over so much of what he had endured in the South and kind of nursed those wounds for as long as he lived. So there was always something missing in a way from the kind of, you know, true enjoyment of all of the success that he had. He kind of had this exile's heart to throughout his life. Second person was George Starling. He actually got a job as a railroad porter, so he was going back and forth between the South and the North, and he kind of was bicultural, bi-regional. He never really was fully one or the other, and that gave him a sense of a kind of psychological freedom because he could move between the two of them. But he also ran into many, many challenges along the way himself, as particularly involving his children, who gave him great disappointment. And then finally, Ida Mae Gladney, who had the least financial and material success of the three, but who actually was maybe the happiest of all and lived the longest of all, because she found a way to incorporate both the best of both the South and the North, which might be a lesson for all of us. In some ways, being able to embrace your original culture and your homeland and mother country, but then be able to also learn and adjust to the new world. You know, when I first met her, she had such a thick Mississippi accent, even though by that time she had spent 60 years in the North, three times as much time in the North as she had in the South, but her Mississippi accent was so thick I could barely understand her. After a few months, I actually could begin to almost imitate her. I got so adjusted to her. But she never changed. She could still make sweet potato pie like the best of them in Mississippi Delta, but she also was, you know, a big fan of the Chicago Bulls and could tell you what Michael Jordan or Dennis Rodman were doing at that time, which is the time that I was spending with her. So she had a way of incorporating all of it, and she was probably the happiest of all, and she lived the longest of all.
Was there a direct relationship between how people adjusted and the place they went? Was it easier, for example, to adjust in Los Angeles than it might have been in Cleveland or New York?
I really believe that for, you're talking 6 million people, so you have 6 million reasons for leaving, 6 million separate precipitating events that would have made a person pick up and leave at that particular time, and 6 million different ways of adjusting to wherever they happen to be. The title of the book, obviously, is The Warmth of Other Suns, which comes from Richard Wright, the great bard of the Great Migration, and it's my belief that in some ways, those other suns represent the hopes and dreams of an individual who it was up to them to make the most of wherever they happened to be. I don't think that you had an advantage in one place or the other. It had so much to do with your own heart, your own heart's desires. One thing about the migration to the West, however, that is particularly relevant to what you're saying is that it took an enormous amount of personal determination, resolve, and in fact resources in order to make it out to the West. It just simply was so much farther from the South than the other parts of the country that I've described. And, you know, if you were to drive, it was a long, treacherous, difficult drive. They could not be assured of being able to stop anywhere along the route, because some places, even out west, would not permit them to stay over in a hotel. They had to make sure they had, you know, all the ice and water that they might need if the radiator overheated. They had to make sure they had all the food they might need. So it was a treacherous, difficult journey. Of course, if you were catching a train, you're talking about a very long ride. In fact, I met someone in the course of interviewing all these people for this book who was actually born on the train. She and her mother couldn't make it all the way to California, so she was born on the train on the way out on the Sunset Limited. So that there is something different about the people who would have migrated to the West. They had to be particularly motivated, and they had to have greater resources. So they tended to be slightly better educated and to have a little bit more wherewithal. So that makes that Western migration from San Diego all the way up to Seattle different from the others.
To what extent have the stories of this great migration been effectively passed along from generation to generation? As in other immigrant stories, oftentimes there's this sense of the homeland, a sense of the way these stories have been passed on. There seems to be a reluctance for those that migrated to talk about all that went on.
You know, that is so true, and that is one of the primary reasons why it has not been written about in this way until now. People didn't talk about it. It was just so painful, so difficult. They wanted to put the past behind them, and in doing so, they also kind of deprived their children and grandchildren of the opportunity to really truly understand the past and where they had come from. One of the reasons why I wanted to do the book was because I myself am a product of the Great Migration. I'm a daughter of the Great Migration on the East Coast stream. My mother migrated from Georgia to Washington, D.C. My father migrated in a different decade to Washington from Southern Virginia. And there they met and married. And had they not migrated, I wouldn't even exist. And that's the case for many, many African Americans who grew up in the North and the West, as well as many Americans who are the product of people who came from different parts of the world and met here. And yet, even though I grew up around people who were from the South and heard the music and the language and exposed to the food and the culture of the South, there was not much talk about why they left or how they left or the circumstances under which they lived when they were in the South. So I didn't hear those stories growing up, and this book gave me an opportunity to understand better why and how I came to be, which is the reason why I wanted to write this. And I had a difficult time even getting my mother to talk about it, because when they left for good. They turned their backs on the South, many of them. They did not. Some took their children back, some did not. My mother didn't take me back very much. Some even changed their names. Dr. Robert Foster actually changed his name on the way out. On the drive out, he decided, I'm not going to be known as Pershing anymore. I'm going to be known as Robert, and preferably Bob. So they turned their backs on it. They looked forward, and they put the past behind them. And along the way, the stories got lost or were not told to the next generation. And I think that people suffered as a result of not knowing how they got there and where they came from. And my goal and hope for this book is that it will inspire people to talk about it more. It will make it okay, make it acceptable to talk about things that, you know, have a hard history but are necessary to be told. And this would be for people of all ethnicities, because there's an immigrant past in most every American's background, and this is an opportunity to tell those stories again and pass them on to the next generation.
From a psychological perspective, what price do you think that African Americans have paid by not passing these stories along, by basically putting this history aside?
Oh, a huge price. I think that a lot of the people who might be considered of a generation, the younger generation that is still trying to find its way, it could be partly because they don't know the history. They don't know the sacrifices. They don't know what people had to go through not that long ago. We're not talking, this is not slavery we're talking about. We're not talking about the 19th century. We're talking about things that were reality until the 1960s and even into the early 1970s. In the lifetime of most Americans alive today. And yet those stories were not passed on, and I think there's an enormous price that African Americans have paid, and in fact an enormous price that all Americans have paid by not truly knowing what has happened so much in our recent past. It's really just not going back that far in order to discover these stories.
Of course, the other side of it is the tremendous impact that this migration had on virtually every one of these northern and western cities and the way it transformed the urban landscape of the country.
Absolutely. The geography of almost every American city in the North and the Midwest and West was affected by this great migration. It was not caused by the migrants. It was the result of the reaction to the Great Migration itself. When these people arrived, they were in some ways viewed as a threat to the pre-existing economic system. Now, they were invited to the North in the beginning because the North had a great need for cheap labor, but they were not really wanted by the people who were ultimately going to be, they feared, displaced or have their wages threatened because the people from the South were used to very, very low wages, if any wages at all, because remember, many of the sharecroppers were working for free. They were essentially working for the right to live on the land that they were farming. And so their arrival meant that there was this potential for them to press down the wages of everyone who was already in the North. And there was great resistance to their arrival, great hostility to their arrival. And as we know, in many neighborhoods wherever the people tried to stretch out to get outside of the ghettos that were created because they were so hemmed in to these central into the least desirable islands of blocks in certain cities, and almost anyone going to any city knows where those neighborhoods or sections are. They were so hemmed in that when those people tried to go into other neighborhoods that would have been primarily white, they ran into such resistance that many of the houses were bombed. There were all kinds of elaborate efforts to keep them from moving in, and ultimately, people, many of the white residents, just emptied out of neighborhoods that they had loved, out of a sense of fear and not knowing, just simply not knowing. And how many lost opportunities were there because people didn't get a chance to know people who ultimately were very much like themselves, particularly for the immigrants who were competing for jobs with them. They actually were the same people of the land who were escaping difficult circumstances, and they arrived in these cities doing some of the same work, working in the slaughterhouses, the foundries, the factories, the assembly line, and yet one group of people, often the people from who had immigrated from Europe, were able to join unions. The African Americans many times were not, and so they were pitted against one another, and that's one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. And we see the effects in the cities today. We see the effects in the way that you have suburbs that developed that were primarily white, and the central cities that were primarily black, and we are living with the effects of this many decades after the migration ended. The other way that we're living with it is the fact that there's so many of the children of this migration who went on to carry on in some ways the amalgamation of the South and the North through their own work and art, literature of the 20th century, Toni Morrison, Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, all of these people wrote about the Great Migration and great literature of the 20th century. Music would not be what it is today if it were not for the Great Migration. Motown itself would simply not exist because the founder of Motown, Berry Gordy, his parents migrated from Georgia to Detroit, where once he got to be a grown man, he decided he wanted to go into music. And where did he get his talent? He got the talent from the people who were right around him. And all of these people around him, the teenagers who were, you know, singing and dancing in church or whatever they were doing, they were children of the South. Diana Ross, her mother migrated from Alabama to Detroit, and her father from West Virginia, and they met in Detroit, and there you have a legend. So the Jackson Five, for example, and the Jackson family, they are descended from a mother who came from Alabama and a father from Arkansas who met in the North. And Motown would simply not exist if it were not for the Great Migration. And finally, jazz. It's hard to imagine what would have even happened had certain people not migrated. It turned out that Miles Davis, his parents were from Arkansas. They migrated to Illinois, where he got the luxury, the indulgence, one might think, if you were in cotton country of Arkansas, to actually play and practice for hours and hours to become the great musician that he did. But he never would have had that opportunity had his parents stayed in Arkansas, working in the cotton country of Arkansas. And Thelonious Monk, his parents migrated from North Carolina to Harlem when he was 5 years old, where he too got the opportunity, the incredible luxury of being able to practice for hours to become the genius that he was as a jazz musician. And then finally, John Coltrane. John Coltrane migrated at 17 from North Carolina to Philadelphia, where, believe it or not, he got his first alto sax. Where would music be, where would jazz be, had he not gone to Philadelphia and got his first alto sax? And he actually practiced so much that the people in his apartment building began to complain because he was playing so much that a minister had to give him the keys of the church. And there he could practice to his heart's content. And these are some of the legacies of the Great Migration.
And finally, how did this migration, this diaspora, play out in setting the stage for the civil rights movement that would happen in the 50s and 60s?
That is such a great question. The Great Migration fills in the blanks of the decades between the start of Jim Crow, which was 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson, the start of separate but equal accommodations, separate but so-called equal accommodations, to the time when the marches and the protests and the sit-ins occurred. And what the role that the Great Migration played in that is that it helped to first put pressure on the South. It showed that the people who were the lowest members of the caste system of Jim Crow had an option, and they were willing to act on that option. They were willing to leave. They were willing to make the ultimate sacrifice and leave family, home, land of the ancestors, and leave for another place, not knowing what would come of it, but willing to leave. So that was one thing. The second thing is that by their leaving, they gave kind of hope and an option and leverage for those who decided to stay. Those who decided to stay would be able to agitate for better treatment and ultimately get the resolve to be able to protest, because they knew that if things did not work out, if for some reason things got so difficult, tight, or violent that they needed to have a place to go, there now was a place to go. They all had cousins and great aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and neighbors, former neighbors, who were now in the North, and they could go and flee if they needed to. That was not the case at the beginning of the 20th century. There was not a large core of people who would be there to receive them if things got difficult. And finally, the people in the Great Migration, the people who had left, were making more money than the people in the South, and they were like any other immigrant group. This is just a facet of what it means to be an immigrant. They were sending money back home. All of them were sending money back home to help to support people who were there, whether it was just a mother who might have needed extra money, but also the effort toward civil rights. So they helped to finance the civil rights movement. So in those three ways, the Great Migration was a precursor to the ultimate moment of truth, where the South was forced ultimately to change.
Isabel Wilkerson. The book is The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. Isabel Wilkerson, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.